You're listening to This Week in Cardiology from theheart.org on Medscape.
Hi, everyone. This is John Mandrola from theheart.org Medscape Cardiology, and this is This Week in Cardiology for June 23rd, 2017. This week, I'm talking saturated fats, anticoagulation based on AFib type, gene defects in unexplained sudden cardiac death, liraglutide, and a new monoclonal antibody that may reduce cardiovascular events. First up is the AHA statement on saturated fats. It was a 25-page document and 139 references, and it was published in the AHA's journal Circulation. Experts from the AHA have reiterated their advice to cut saturated fats and replace it with polyunsaturated fats, mostly from vegetable oils. Now, chief among the reasons for doing this is that saturated fat raises LDL, a marker, a surrogate of heart disease. Many of the studies cited in this presidential advisory paper were conducted decades ago. Of course, an electrophysiologist does not have the answer on nutrition, but I suspect it's not as clear as the AHA experts make it out to be. The thing is, their advice does matter. People will listen. Simple messages are sticky. So if they are wrong, and a lot of smart people think they are, this doubling down on the fat hypothesis could do a lot of harm. That said, I don't think the anti-sugar proponents have all the answers either. I think experts in nutrition would do well to embrace uncertainty. My simplistic view of heart disease prevention goes way upstream from the specific nutrients in food. Instead of speculative advice on macronutrients, I wish we would spend more energy on ways to bring walkable neighborhoods, good education, adequate support for childcare, and then we can talk about fine-tuning on what to eat. The next topic is about anticoagulation, and it's about anticoagulation use and the type of atrial fibrillation. This was a large database study looking at millions of patients in the UK, and it found that anticoagulation use is increasing, but there is a differential in the use depending on the type of AFib, that is, intermittent or persistent forms of AFib. Now, if all the doctors followed the guidelines to the T, this would not be the case because current guideline recommendations for anticoagulation are based on the stroke risk, but not the type of atrial fibrillation. A group of researchers from the University of Birmingham in the UK published their results in the journal Heart. The chief finding was that patients with paroxysmal AFib, intermittent AFib, were 20% less likely to receive oral anticoagulation than patients with persistent or permanent forms of AFib. The study included an analysis of data from 2000 to 2015, and the anticoagulation gap is decreasing. But this study makes the podcast because it's an area of uncertainty. I know guidelines say to approach the stroke prevention in all forms of AFib the same way. But two big factors suggest that this presumption may need revisiting. One factor is that numerous observational studies suggest a higher risk of stroke in non-paroxysmal forms of AFib. And these findings pass the common sense test. It's hard to believe that permanent atrial fibrillation is the same risk as 2 or 3 minutes of intermittent paroxysmal AFib. Another new development is that we are on the precipice of a great rise in paroxysmal AFib incidence. This is due to the rise in devices capable of detecting our heart rhythm. Whether these so-called subclinical forms of AFib confer the same risk of stroke is yet to be determined. Next topic is about gene abnormalities in unexplained sudden cardiac death. Canadian authors from the University of British Columbia added to the accumulating evidence that a high percentage of survivors of unexplained cardiac arrest have pathogenic gene variants. In this study, which was published in Circ Genetics, it used the CASPER registry, which is a large registry of cardiac arrest survivors where the initial assessment reveals no obvious cause for cardiac arrest. For instance, normal coronaries, normal LV function, and normal resting ECG. The CASPER registry included cases from 2006 to 2015. There were 375 unexpected cardiac arrests, and 174 of these patients had genetic tests done. Variants in the genetic material considered possibly pathogenic were found in 17% of patients. 60% were variants associated with a channel protein, but 40% associated with a cardiomyopathy gene. And gene variants of unknown significance, however, VUS, variants of unknown significance, were found in 18% of patients. In patients who had a negative phenotype, for instance, no QT prolongation, using a broad multi-phenotype testing led to higher yields, but these broad multi-genetic tests found more variants of unknown significance. Professors Chris Samsarian and Arthur Wild wrote the editorial, and the editorial is open access and it's really excellent. They make the points that broader genetic testing may be more sensitive, but it also picks up more genetic noise. This point applies to genetic testing in general. The editorials also observed that nearly half the unexpected cardiac arrest patients had gene abnormalities associated with cardiomyopathy. And that's weird because the echo and cath of these patients showed no problems. So they speculated on why this may be. Perhaps its susceptibility to arrhythmia may precede the onset of structural disease, or perhaps it's just statistical noise. And they say that this needs further study. Fourth topic today is liraglutide. Now, doctors prescribe liraglutide, a glucagon-like peptide 1 inhibitor analog for the treatment of adults with type 2 diabetes, along with diet and exercise, to improve glycemic control and possibly reduce weight. This week, an FDA advisory panel recommended 12-2 that liraglutide gain an indication. And the indication is to reduce the risk of major adverse cardiac events, such as CV death, non-fatal MI, or non-fatal stroke, in adults with type 2 diabetes and high CV risk. The recommendation was based on the LEADER trial, which was a cardiovascular outcomes trial done in approximately 9,000 patients with type 2 diabetes. LEADER was actually a post-market approval study. Remember that the FDA required type 2 diabetes drugs have a CV outcomes trial. So liraglutide was first approved in 2010, and LEADER trial was published in 2016. And the LEADER trial showed an absolute risk reduction in the primary endpoint, this composite primary endpoint. The absolute risk reduction was 1.9%. The Medscape medical news story on the surrounding issues, including a comparison of GLP-1 drugs with the SGLPT drugs, is really, it's quite a good article. I learned a lot from it. Two criticisms of the LEADER trial that were discussed in the FDA committee was, one, investigators did not observe the same benefits in the subgroup of U.S. patients. Why would that be? I don't know. The committee also discussed the possible increased risk of pancreatic and thyroid cancer with the GLP-1 drugs. The final topic today is about an interesting new monoclonal antibody that I'm going to have trouble pronouncing. Before yesterday, I had never heard of this drug called canakinumab. That was until Novartis put out a press release this week in which they announced the novel drug significantly reduced the risk of cardiovascular death, non-fatal MI, and non-fatal stroke in patients who had prior MI and inflammatory atherosclerosis in a phase 3 multicenter trial called CANTOS, C-A-N-T-O-S. Now, please note that this was a mere press release of the results of an RCT. As I learned in Patrice Wendling's superb news story, canakinumab is already approved for subcutaneous use in some rare autoimmune diseases, and it works by targeting the interleukin-1 beta cytokine, which is a key cytokine in the inflammation pathway. Another thing I learned in the story is that a paper published yesterday in the New England Journal of Medicine was able to show that people who acquire mutations in their blood cells as they age are predisposed to blood cancer, but also surprisingly to MI. And the reason these patients may develop an MI seems to be through the interleukin-1 beta inflammation pathway. Now, it's too early to say much more about this now, but stay tuned. I suspect big news will be made when this trial is released, probably at the ESC meeting in 2 months. So that's it for this week in cardiology. I'm grateful that you listened. Thank you. Until next week, this is John Mandrola from the Heart.org Medscape Cardiology.
You're listening to This Week in Cardiology from the Heart.org on Medscape.